Our scripture reading for this morning comes from the 17th chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew, and this is Matthew's account of the transfiguration on the mountain. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah, talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud a voice said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up, don't be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." Years ago, when I was in my first situation where I was preaching in seminary, what is called field education, which does not take place in a field, of course. It takes place in a church, usually. And I had the opportunity, along with the other student that was with me, to preach actually a lot more than seminary students usually have the opportunity to do. And I have to admit, they heard some pretty awful sermons. This church was the first place I had ever preached, period. So we had, as most congregations do, a variety of people. And there was one guy named Jim. And during the second year that I was there, Jim's wife died rather suddenly. And I participated in the funeral. And actually, he had done this before, but after the time that his wife had died, he was a very active member, so he was in worship most Sundays. Jim would be in the last row of the church. Now, it wasn't a very big building, so it wasn't nearly as large as this one. And he would be sitting in the back row, usually with his arm kind of stretched out away from the flame, and would have his head down. Like this. He'd do this especially during the sermon. Which, you know, and that's where I learned that, I can actually figure out who stayed up late the night before. Or excuse them if I knew that they were a farmer and they had been up since 3 a.m. milking the cows. But that was not the case with him. So as we were doing, the two of us, the other student and I, were doing sort of a wrap-up at the end of the year for the time that we had together, the senior pastor said, "You know, there's several people that have enjoyed your sermons, but there's one person in particular, and it was Jim Glidewell." And I said, "Don, how could that possibly be? Jim slept through every single sermon that I ever preached." He said he wasn't sleeping. He was listening. And that's always stuck with me. That for Jim, the way that he would listen would be to close his eyes and find a very comfortable position and just listen. Now, I can imagine the next week we're going to have half of the people in the congregation will be doing that, right? Right? Okay. And I'll know that you're listening very carefully. So that was his way of shutting out his thoughts And in the months after his wife's death, as those of you that have lost a spouse or a significant family member know, that there's a lot of stuff you have to work through, and it's not easy. And that was one of the ways that he did that. And it did help him, as it turns out. So we want to think about worship today, but also, along with that, how we experience the presence of God. Using this metaphor, the transfiguration, just to think about how that happens. This is, to our ears, I think, a rather strange text. But we can look at it in context. In the chapter prior to this one, we find Jesus asking the disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And then, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter blurts out, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Jesus' response is, "In 3 days, he will be killed, or I will soon be killed in Jerusalem, and then on the third day will be raised. And if anyone wants to be a follower, you have to take up your cross and you have to follow me." And then we come to the transfiguration, which in a sense, perhaps, in the mind of the editor who put Matthew together, this vision may have been an answer to the question, "Who do you say that I am?" So we find Jesus and Peter and James and John going up to the top of the mountain. There is a mountain in the Holy Land that is believed by many to be the place where the transfiguration took place. It's a high mountain, Mount Tabor, which is a rather unusual geologic feature. It's called a monadnock, which is a big stone mountain that just kind of rises out of a plain. And it's named after a place in New England. Mount Monadnock is the same kind of mountain, just a solid rock of a mountain that comes right out of the plain. So here we find in the Holy Land a geologic feature, the type of which is named after a mountain in southern New Hampshire. I like that. And there's a large Roman Catholic basilica up on the top. And I did not have the chance to visit it, but I did see it from a distance. And I'm told it's a wonderful place to go and just to sit and contemplate. It's often very quiet there. And as they get up to the mountaintop, they have this experience that is described in Matthew, where Jesus' clothing suddenly turns a dazzling white. And that may not in itself sound like a terribly surprising thing, but in a place where it was really hard to get clothing that was brilliantly white, that in itself would be kind of an unusual thing. I don't think this involved a wardrobe change on Jesus' part, but I mean, who knows? And the disciples somehow have this vision of Moses and Elijah on either side talking with Jesus. Now, if you look on your bulletin cover for this morning, I have very handily a Greek Orthodox or Russian Orthodox icon of the Transfiguration. And I appreciate the depictions of the Transfiguration and icons because they don't try to depict anything realistically, what it would really look like. Instead, it's almost in an abstract. So you find Jesus in the middle with this aura of white, and Moses and Elijah. And down below, in the traditional way that they are depicted, you have the three apostles, Peter, James, and John. You can't really see it, but there's a line going right from the stars, and it goes right down to them, almost as if they have a feeling of being zapped. And one of the apostles, I believe it's James, is always shown almost like he's been bowled over. So this is a wonderful way of depicting this event that is almost beyond description. It turns out in a lot of the Jewish literature at the time of Jesus that seeing God or experiencing God could result in almost a a feeling of being full of light, and that your appearance could actually change into almost a white, bright light. And in this vision that the disciples have, Moses and Elijah are to either side of Jesus. Moses representing the law, the Torah. Elijah representing the prophets. And the implication that Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. And then the voice that comes to their minds and says, "This is my son, listen to him." This is one of those events, and we find a number of these in the scriptures, where you have to almost suspend the rational mind and just accept it for what it is. Is it a vision? Did they have too much to drink the night before? We don't know. There's no explanation. It's simply offered as a vision as it is. In the ancient world, and I think we still have a sense of this now, a metaphor for how you experience God's presence is you go to a high place. And it's a very common thing in cultures all around the world that places of worship would often be on mountains. If you want to experience God, you go away to a mountain. And here in New England, where we have lots of mountains, and forget about what the people out in the Rockies say, that we don't really have mountains. Ours are a lot older than theirs are, okay? We go to mountaintops, don't we? And you have the sense of being separated away from everything. And you can see the busy world below you. But up where you are, it's quiet. It's no surprise that being on a mountaintop is a place where you can almost hear the voice of God. We find Jesus several times in the Gospels going up onto a mountain to spend the night in prayer. And so what Jesus does when he brings them up to this mountain to have this vision, he's bringing them to the place where they can experience God's presence, perhaps in a way that they might not in the rest of the mundane world. So when we come together to worship, we are placing ourselves in a position to experience God's presence in a way that we may not during the rest of the week. Now, perhaps to the rest of the world, this seems to be kind of strange. I mean, think about it. We're here on a Sunday morning. What kinds of things could you be doing on a Sunday morning, especially in weather like this, right? And you're listening to some guy wearing a medieval black robe talking. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, but this is what we do. But it just begins here. The worship and the presence of God that we experience here doesn't end here. It begins. I'm sure that Peter and James and John have a strong sense of that as they are up on the mountain. And they naturally, they want to have that experience just last forever. Peter says, "Wouldn't it be great if we built three little shelters, one for you and one for me and one for Moses and Elijah?" What he's referring to is a Jewish festival, the Festival of Tabernacles, in which they remember their time in the wilderness and they build temporary booths or lean-tos. In New York City, in the Orthodox neighborhoods, you can see these built out on the fire escapes. It's quite a sight. And it is a joyous holiday in the Jewish calendar. It's a wonderful holiday. And so I can imagine that Peter being up there and having this experience would naturally think of another time of worship that was joyous and almost ecstatic. He wants to stay there because somehow he has a sense of God's presence in a way he hasn't felt before. So when we are here together, what we experience as worship is just the beginning. If Sunday morning is the only time that we pray or read or hear the words of the scriptures, then that's not enough. The purpose of worship is for us to come together and to collectively, together, experience God's presence. And for some, there, for any one of you, there may be different parts of a worship service that you derive more meaning from than others. It may be music. Music is often the thing that brings people to worship. It could simply just be a time when you can suspend all your worries and anxieties. You may come to hear the fabulous preaching. I mean, it could be anything. It could be anything. But this is a time for us to practice what the Buddhists call mindfulness, just to forget about everything else. But we know that we bring our baggage with us, our worries. We bring all that stuff with us. Let me share with you a thought from an English text that was written in the 1300s that has become quite popular. It's called The Cloud of Unknowing. And it was written, the name of the person is not known, but it's believed to have been written by an English priest in the 1300s, somewhere in rural England. And in this text, he tells us that all people have two different sorts of powers or abilities. One is of knowing, of knowledge of our minds. The other is love. Our minds are rational, at least we hope they are. And our hearts, where we experience love, is non-rational. Not irrational. That's not it at all. Non-rational. And he tells us that there is a cloud between us and God. Sometimes you feel that cloud pretty strongly if you feel in crisis and you wonder where God is. And that cloud can't be penetrated by our powers of knowing, our rational minds. To penetrate that cloud, he says, we can do it through love, through loving God. Sounds an awful lot like that summation of the law that Jesus offers. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and your soul and your mind and your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. When we come to worship together, we bring our whole person. And Jesus doesn't just tell us, love the Lord your God with your mind. In Western culture, I think we tend to do a lot of that. Worship, especially for Protestants, worship is from here up. And the rest of our bodies just come along for the ride because they have to. But when we worship together, there is so much beyond just our rational thinking minds. I know that there are times during a worship service, and believe it or not, I worship while I'm leading worship. It takes a while to learn how to do that. And I've been known to skip over things in a worship service. One time, and I've only done this twice in my entire career, I forgot the offering. Let me tell you, I heard about that. And I haven't forgotten the offering in over 25 years. But that's what happens, you know, when you suspend the rational mind and you simply focus on the love of God that suffuses the words and the music. And it's okay if sometimes the service goes a little bit longer, or if you forget yourself in whatever part of the service has really spoken to you. We experience God's presence through love. But then there's that thing of all the stuff that we bring with us. All our worries, problems at home or at work, worries about a friend or a loved one. We've all been there. Worried about something that is coming up that you're really not looking forward to. We don't come here with a clean slate. We don't. We bring stuff with us. When we come together to worship, try thinking about mindfulness, just being in the moment, just like Peter. Peter, when he was up there, was just so enraptured. He didn't want to leave it. Worship is not just an expression of our rational mind. It's an experience of our hearts loving God, but it doesn't stop with just loving God. Because as Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and your soul and your mind and your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. That's why they don't stay up on the mountain. They don't. They go down. In the different Gospels, what comes after the Transfiguration differs a little bit, because a lot of these stories didn't necessarily happen in chronological order. The person that was editing the Gospel just put them in a particular order because it made sense. In Matthew, they go down from the mountain and Jesus heals. And he even tells them, don't tell anybody about this. Not yet. Now, how are you going to do that? You have an experience like that, and he says, what happens when we come down from the mountain is we love one another. And that's really the fulfillment of worship. Not to stay on the mountain, although it's great to be caught up in that feeling of love and of warmth and of security and assurance that we are in the mind of God. Take some time for yourself every day, every single day, and just stop what you're doing and breathe. That's all you have to do. Just breathe. You do it anyway, hopefully. And experience that powerful love that is with you always. And you will know the love of God. Amen.